What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on a supersized Squawk Pod. The SEC's crypto enforcement, the top financial regulator, suing two crypto exchanges.
The SEC is supposed to be a stable agency, that it's not supposed to be a political...
But it is.
One of those firms speaking out, Coinbase CEO Brian Armstrong.
They're saying everything other than Bitcoin is a security. Well, that's not our interpretation of the law, and that's not what the position of every other country around the world, their financial regulators, is taking.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen weighs in on crypto, the debt ceiling, and our country's future.
I don't think there's a trade-off between investing in America and doing spending that will improve the trajectory for our economy and running a responsible fiscal policy.
And the shocking merger between the PGA Tour and deep-pocketed Saudi rival LIV Golf, ending a bitter war of words.
What they were saying was, it's all about the trophies and the history. And now we know it's really not all about just the trophies and the history.
It's Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue please.
Good morning. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We are live from the heart of the most polluted city in the world, right here, Times Square, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks to the Canadian wildfires, we have seen the worst
air
pollution
quality.
Anywhere, the worst air quality anywhere in the world, worse than Beijing, worse than New Delhi.
For ozone? I mean, it's not, we don't have just most, toxic chemical. We don't have
But the pollutants in the air.
Well, it's not sulfur dioxide.
Did you smell it last night? The allergies are up.
The sun looked
real.
The sun looked bizarre. Did you see the sun?
Yep. It did. I saw the moon the night before.
Bizarre.
It was red. I thought it was a reflection of the sun. That's not the case. Yeah, this is New York City, so welcome. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Meantime, the SEC filing an emergency motion in a federal court in Washington, D.C. last night, asking a judge to freeze the assets of Binance's U.S. platform. Now, that would be for anywhere in the world. That order would only apply to the U.S. holding companies, not the unregulated international exchange. The SEC arguing that the restraining order was necessary to, quote, prevent the dissipation of available assets for any judgment given the defendant's years of volatile conduct. The order also seeking to prevent Binance from destroying evidence. Binance's CEO, CZ, tweeting, clarifying the order could only affect Binance U.S. if granted by the court and would not affect Binance.com. And we've always talked about the idea that there's Binance and then Binance U.S. And was Binance U.S. a sort of marketing proxy to get people in the United States to use a VPN service, to use the unregulated service abroad? So
I guess the
speaks to a lot of it.
The U.S. regulators can't stop anything but the U.S. arm.
Right.
That's why they'd be seeking
that. That's all they have.
The court hasn't granted that
right.
yet. We know they've already been accused of commingling funds and moving funds from
right.
one place to place. You got to wonder if there's any more movement that's taking place ahead of a potential
right
court
now.
Order.
Interesting. We're also watching shares of Coinbase this morning. This after a 12% decline in yesterday's session. Comes after the SEC sued the company, accusing it of operating an unregistered securities exchange. Coinbase's CEO, Brian Armstrong, said in a tweet that the company would be proud to fight the suit, and he's going to join us right here in a first on CNBC interview.
When this deal came out and all the investors ran up Coinbase to $60 billion, it was unregistered. They were unregistered securities. Everybody knew. This is your point.
Right.
It was well known by all the regulators that they were not registered, right? Suddenly yesterday, yesterday it became a big deal that they're unregistered.
There was a new cop on the beat. If you looked back, Coinbase went public 3 days before Gary Gensler took over at the SEC. It takes time to build it.
What about the people that had $60 billion?
Look, he was pushed on this yesterday by the crew on Squawk on the Street, and they said, why didn't you do something sooner? He said, look, it takes time to build an investigative piece on this to really go after all of this and put it together.
Here's the problem in my mind.
Without being granted blessing.
You can't.
I think it's
you move the goalpost, pull the rug out.
We've talked about the idea that you're right. Gary Gensler showed up 3 days after this all happened, and Jake Clayton had been gone before this happened.
So
this
so
sort
nobody.
Of. Yes, and no. There are commissioners at the SEC. The SEC is supposed to be a stable agency. That it's not supposed to be a political or
oriented
organization
that
somehow makes one decision in one day and makes another decision another day. If the idea is there's the credibility of the marketplace, that's the entire business of the SEC. And I would argue that what's happening right now, unfortunately, is undermining the credibility of all of it.
Right. If you start doing that, how do you ever have any confidence in anything you do in the future if the next guy who comes in does something that
this happens all the time? Like, talk to AT&T when they were doing a deal and look at the FCC and they changed the rules of what an actual illegal putting together of two different companies would be and how they would measure that and why.
This is different. It's saying that all of a sudden the unregistered nature of it is.
It's brand new stuff. Well, look, the rules have not been developed here. You knew that the rules and regulations
were going to be. What do you tell people that had $60 billion invested?
Buyer beware on some of this stuff.
Not when the SEC signs off on it, and then a new SEC comes in and doesn't sign off on it.
To me, here's the one distinction. If we were talking about a company that was not in the financial space, in the financial sector, an exchange unto itself, which is what Coinbase is, if we were talking about a lawnmower company, you don't assume that the SEC could allow the lawnmower company to go public and that they are not making a decision about whether the lawnmowers that they're selling are great
legit
lawnmowers,
yeah,
or bad lawnmowers. However, when they are blessing the IPO of a company that's going public that is effectively a financial exchange, I think that there's a different, and maybe there shouldn't be.
That's a fair point.
But I think there is in the mind's eye of people who are involved in this.
That's a fair point. The other thing I will say is Brian Armstrong has a much stronger case. There is no comparison between the SEC's complaint against Coinbase and what they're saying about CZ and everything that's
that undermines him too. It looks like this to everybody.
I don't think there's anything the same.
Scattershot anybody
in
crypto.
Brian Armstrong can probably make a very big, good case about how they'll say we're going to go along with this and register, and then we're going to be brought into the.
That hurts their case against Binance. Which is it?
It doesn't.
If
you read the actual complaints against
Binance,
they're
going after everyone. They ought to just focus on that then.
Binance, they're saying, is a fraud. But I think if you are looking at setting rules of the road, Congress hasn't acted. I don't know why they haven't in years been able to pull something together and say this is what the rules are going to be.
Realistically, they're not going to ever.
Ever. And
ever.
That's the frustration.
Ever. Join us right now, first on CNBC, is Coinbase's CEO, Brian Armstrong. Good morning to you. We've been debating this at the table, but we're glad to have you at the table to join in on this discussion. Help us understand from your perspective, when you first saw this lawsuit, what your reaction was, and to the extent that you have a defense, and I know you've taken to Twitter, but now you can take to the airwaves, what it is.
Yeah, I mean, we were disappointed to see this complaint from the SEC because I feel like we've had a long history of being very transparent with them and really every regulator around the world that we've worked with. So even going back to 2021, when we became a public company, before becoming a public company, you have to disclose everything about your business in depth. There was many back and forth revisions of our S-1. And frankly, they had all the knowledge then, and they allowed us to become a public company. And then we're going through time, and Chair Gensler has statements to Congress saying that he doesn't feel he has the authority to regulate this industry. And we're seeing conflicting statements from the CFTC and the SEC chair. And we even filed a formal petition with the SEC asking them for clarity about a number of points in the law, which they never responded to. And then this Wells notice and a complaint arrives. And so this isn't good for America. It's not good for the industry, obviously. And we now need to go get clarity from the courts.
I want to show you. Chair Gensler was on CNBC yesterday. I want to show you a clip and get you to react, if I could. Take a look at this.
In the Coinbase complaint, we note that they have, through the Coinbase wallet, you can trade 16,000 different tokens. And there's a lot of debate as to the use cases and whether there's any there. Look, we don't need more digital currency. We already have digital currency. It's called the US dollar. It's called the euro. It's called the yen. They're all digital right now. We already have digital investments. And you have entrepreneurs representing digital investments on this program all day long. And it's whether it's the big tech companies, the automobile companies, you name it. It's all digital right now, the investing world. So what is the real underlying value of these tokens? And that's why you need full, fair, and truthful disclosures.
Do you think this is about disclosures, or do you think this is about the underlying currencies that are on your exchange?
It's tough to know what he means by that. I mean, our self-custodial wallet is not trading crypto, the ones that he mentioned some huge number. That's happening in DeFi. That's not something that we actually operate the trading of. Our centralized exchange is really trading a much smaller number of assets. We've reviewed, you know, over 1,000 assets in crypto. We rejected 90% of them because we felt they weren't appropriate for our exchange. And about 200 of them are listed on our centralized product. And I don't know, to his point about, you know, what's the there.
Right.
People are using crypto for all kinds of things. They're not just trading, and they're doing payments with it. You know, Ukraine raised $200 million, and presidential candidates are taking it. And it's a new technology that can be used to update all kinds of financial services. And we don't need the government picking and choosing our technology winners. Let's let the market decide that.
When you spoke just earlier about the IPO and the IPO process and the back and forth that you had with the SEC, I think implicit within what you were saying was that they approved us as a business. And yet the prospectus itself, as you know, also says very clearly that effectively the SEC has not opined on the underlying business itself. And in fact, that the company can't actually legally say publicly that the SEC has. Do you agree with that?
Well, they allowed us to become a public company understanding the S-1, right? And so I feel like that's our moment to be totally transparent with them, show them everything about our business and how it operates. And so it's not great to have a regulator sort of come back later and say, actually, we changed our mind.
Change their mind. We had John Stark, their former SEC Office of Internet Enforcement Chief for 11 years. He was on earlier. He said it's very specific that in the IPO, the SEC does not approve these things. And it says very specifically they could come back and say that there is additional regulation that's required, or additional disclosures, or additional filings. And I think what they're very specific about is you call yourself an exchange, you call yourself a broker-dealer when it comes to Prime. Those are things that you need to register for if you're going to be either an exchange or a broker-dealer, just like the NASDAQ or the NYSE would have to.
Well, so a couple points. One is that if you're trading commodities, you know, that doesn't necessarily apply, right? We have actually gone out there and acquired a broker-dealer license because we wanted the ability to trade crypto securities. There could be a big, robust market of crypto securities trading in the U.S., even though we don't list any securities today. And by the way, I think you're right. The regulator does have the right to come, you know, edit their thinking at times and come back and say, you know, here's a new set of rules. And great, we'd be happy to follow those. The issue in this case is that we're getting conflicting statements from the CFTC head and the SEC head. And then the statements from the SEC are so, you know, such an outlier. They're saying everything other than Bitcoin is a security. Well, that's not our interpretation of the law. That's not what the law says. And that's not what the position of every other country around the world, their financial regulators, is taking. And so I don't think we really had a choice, honestly. We had to go to court to really see if this, otherwise this industry is just not going to exist in the United States if we took that position.
Warning there could be additional regulation is one thing, but you know, bringing enforcement action on something you knew full well at the time was occurring, that I don't see how all of a sudden you make that leap. That just seems arbitrary and capricious and vindictive almost.
That is a regulation by enforcement approach. And, you know, we met with the SEC 30 times in the last year. They never gave us a single piece of feedback about what we could be doing better. We just got silence. And when we asked them, how would you like us to register? You know, we have this dormant broker-dealer license. Could we activate that? We really got silence. And so it's not appropriate for the regulator to come back and do an enforcement action if we don't have a clear rule book and clear guidance.
Congress has not done anything. Is it your only hope that Congress does something and acts, or that a judge rules on this? Because, look, there is case law. And again, the argument's been made that if they look at these things as security and judge them as such, you could be subject to everything the SEC is saying here.
Well, there's a couple of paths how this could be resolved. So one is, we go through the court system. And I don't think there's really case law created that's relevant to crypto yet. In fact, that would be a good outcome, kind of regardless of what the court decides, as we start to get clarity, you know. Another option is, like you said, Congress is starting to act. So last week we saw the McHenry-Thompson bill draft that came out. This is the start of something really, you know, useful, which is a clear market structure for crypto, clear delineation between what the CFTC and the SEC are supposed to do, clear consumer protections around wash trading and AML and these kinds of things. So, you know, there's probably little details that need to be worked out, and I know that lots of people in Congress are starting to look at that. There's a few other bills being drafted as well, but that's it. We either need to get the clarity, I think, at this point from Congress or the courts, and they seem to have an interest in doing
that. It seems hard to have government agencies, whether it's the FTC or the SEC, that really seem overtly political. It depends on who gets elected every 4 years, and that's not... Isn't it stated somewhere that these agencies are supposed to act in an apolitical way where...
Except that the commissioners, and then it's like, let me ask you a separate question, which is, this is all happening against the backdrop of a case that's very different, but still in the news against Binance. And a lot of these things are getting conflated together. What was your reaction to that suit?
Yeah, well, obviously, I don't want to comment on any other companies, but, you know, the timing was curious to put those back to back. And there may have been an intentional, you know, desire to conflate the two or something like that. But the companies could really not be more different, and the suits could not be more different. So, you know, in Coinbase's case, for instance, there hasn't been any allegation of misappropriation of customer funds. You know, I haven't been named personally. The executives haven't been named personally. The complaint in the Coinbase situation is really a technical matter about, do you classify these as commodities or securities? And, you know, we're based here in the U.S. We've never operated a hedge fund or something that trades against our customers. All of our financial statements are audited, you know, the customer segregation of funds and everything like that. People can take someone else's word for it, not ours.
In retrospect, do you think you would have been better off not going public? And I ask because I think there's probably a lot of public investors that, you know, went along for this ride, maybe very well should have known that part of this was a gamble and bet on not just your ability to execute as a business, but that the regulations and the laws would cut your way over time.
I don't regret going public. I mean, there's certainly some things about being a public company which are a little more difficult. You know, the private marks and valuations, I think, you know, you can sort of defy reality a little bit for longer. Right. But no, I'm glad we became a public company because I want us to go first. It's not easy to go first. You're going to take a few arrows. You know, we have to educate the public market investors. We have to deal with the SEC. But that's what being the leader in the space means. And so we're happy to do that.
Hey, Brian, no argument that you are very different than what we're seeing with Binance, the allegations that are made with FTX. Those are like flat out fraud charges. That is not what is in this complaint. Mm-hmm. But there could be some pretty serious repercussions as a result. It's not just a technical issue. Depending on how things are ruled on this, the SEC is asking for disgorgement of your ill-gotten gains and to pay prejudgment interest thereon. They refer back to 2021 when you had $6.8 billion in transaction revenue out of $7.4 billion total revenue. It sounds like there's a lot riding on this, even though they are not alleging any of the things that have been alleged in the cases against Binance and FTX.
Well, obviously, it's a serious matter, but you have to remember that, you know, we list over 200 assets. The complaint just names 13 of them, so it's a pretty small percentage of the assets that we trade. And, you know, it's also worth noting that a lot of our revenue now comes from non-trading fees. It's almost 50% of our revenue is from non-trading fees. And we also have revenue outside the U.S., which isn't affected by this.
But the $6.8 billion in 2021 that they point to from transaction revenue, is that what they are talking about?
That would be 100% of our trading fee revenue, I believe, in that year.
And it's your understanding that that's not what they're talking about?
Well, their complaint only references 13 of the 200-plus assets that we trade. So, yeah.
Let me ask you a different question just about, given the challenges you're facing, I know we'll put Binance in a different category, but the challenges the industry is facing. Mm-hmm. For those who are invested currently in crypto or thinking about it, what do you tell them today? And where do you think this all heads over the short term, medium term, long term?
Yeah, well, the fundamentals have not changed, right? Crypto is the most important technology we have to update the financial system. And I think 80% of Americans feel the financial system is in need of an update. It's too slow, it's too expensive, it's not equal access for everybody. And so, you know, and crypto is being used for more and more things too. It started as this kind of new asset class that people were trading, sometimes speculatively, but now people are using it as a new form of money and payments, and they're using it as new types of financial services, and even things which have nothing to do with financial services, you know, like identity and artwork and voting and governance, and it's kind of Web3, you know, the next application platform for the internet. So it's still very early days. There's a lot of work that we need to do as a company to try to make crypto easier to use, more scalable, and yes, go get regulatory clarity. But you know, I think I always tell people the same thing. You know, don't invest money that you're unwilling to lose. This is a new field of technology. It's one of the most important technology fields in the world. But don't speculate with assets that you're unwilling to lose.
I want to thank you, Brian. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so very, very much.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen joins us exclusively in her first comments after the passage of the bitterly debated but eventually bipartisan debt ceiling deal.
Had the debt ceiling not been raised, regardless of what approach was taken, the consequences would have been very adverse, very significant, and very negative. I believe a recession would have been very likely, and we could have had a global financial crisis.
Squawk Pod, we'll be right back.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC.
Up and Andrew, cue.
Good morning and welcome back to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We're live at the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin along with Joe Kernan and Becky Quick. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen joins us now exclusively in her first interview since the debt ceiling deal was passed. Secretary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
So we're all trying to, I mean, the good news is that's behind us. But there's a lot in front of us. We still seem to have a very strong economy, possibly a little too strong. Where do you think we really are?
Well, you know, I've been saying now for almost a year that I see a path to bringing down inflation while maintaining a strong labor market. And I think the data we've seen recently and over the last year suggest we're on a path with those characteristics. So clearly the labor market remains quite strong with unemployment close to 50-year lows and very healthy job creation. But on the other hand, we are seeing some signs of easing pressures in the labor market, which may be important in terms of bringing inflation down. The quit rate has risen slightly. Job openings have declined somewhat, suggesting a bit less pressure in terms of firms adding to their workforce. But overall, the labor market remains very strong, and inflation has now come down about 4% from its peak. And I think we'll continue to see progress over the next 2 years.
But do you what do you think unemployment has to be in this country to actually and to have inflation actually level off? We keep talking about what the Fed can or can't do, but politically, part of that is a question about employment in this country.
Well, to me, a strong labor market is one where individuals who want to work can quickly find work. We've always thought an unemployment rate with 4 is the first digit is a very strong labor market. Clearly, Americans feel good about their job prospects. They're finding work quickly. The hiring pressure, and it's not just a matter of the unemployment rate that determines pressures in the labor market. It's also the job vacancies and how strong the appetite is of firms to hire. The economy has slowed somewhat, and we're seeing less pressure by firms trying to rebuild their workforces. but we still have a very healthy labor market. Wage gains are significant, but nevertheless, we're seeing a bit of easing of pressures.
Madam Secretary, I don't know if you can take us behind the scenes now that the debt ceiling deal is complete. How close did we really get? And I know prior to the deal, you'd be asked the question, you know, whose bills were you going to pay first and what kind of preparations were you making? And I think you didn't really want to answer the question. Now that that's off the table, can you tell us a little bit about how that all would have worked?
Well, what I can tell you is that what I said and what President Biden said from the outset is that to protect our economy and our financial markets from catastrophe, what's necessary is to find a consensual, bipartisan approach to raising the debt ceiling. And that was my focus. That was President Biden's focus. That was what was achieved. I think it's a win for the American people because had the debt ceiling not been raised, regardless of what approach was taken, the consequences would have been very adverse, very significant, and very negative. I, you know, believe a recession would have been very likely, and we could have had a global financial crisis, higher interest rates for a very long time. So fortunately, although our balance dipped to very low levels, we continued to be able to pay all of America's bills. And there was, it's important to realize there was a commitment from all parties in this negotiation not to default on the debt, to find a bipartisan solution. And I think it's a win for the American people that that occurred. And it's also important to recognize that Social Security and Medicare were protected. Medicaid was protected. Had that not occurred, 21 million Americans could have lost health care. Veterans' benefits were protected. And as important, now that our economy is operating in the vicinity of full employment, we're very focused on investing in America, strengthening long-term prospects for our economy to make it more competitive, to create good jobs. Mm. And the trifecta of legislation that was passed, the CHIPS and Science Act, the Infrastructure Act, those both bipartisan, the Inflation Reduction Act, the important things there have been preserved.
Right. Madam Secretary, I guess it, not everyone agrees, obviously, depends on where you're sitting. But some people think a lot of that spending contributed to the 40-year highs that we saw in inflation, with a lot of other factors as well. That contributes to a 525 basis point increase in rates. That makes investing in all these things more difficult, since so much of what we bring in needs to be spent on servicing our debt. So it seems like it's a really difficult sort of a conundrum that we want to spend money on things to help people, but the more we spend, the less we have left over after we service our debt. Do you think we need to cut spending somewhere where we can, so we can spend it in better places?
Well, look, this bipartisan agreement just cut the deficit by $1 trillion. And right. The deficit fiscal stimulus has declined, certainly since the pandemic ended. So that is supporting the Fed's efforts to bring inflation down. I don't think there's a trade-off between investing in America and doing spending that will improve the trajectory for our economy and job prospects. There's not a conflict between that and running a responsible fiscal policy. President Biden offered a budget that has significant further investments in our economy while lowering deficits over 10 years by $3 trillion. But revenue needs to be part of that discussion. It's not all a matter of spending. I think we, in the interest of tax fairness and having the resources to invest in our economy, we also need to be considering proposals that would enhance revenue while also controlling spending.
Secretary Yellen, we just spoke with the former Richmond Fed president, Jeffrey Lacker, and he said that he actually thinks that we're going to have to take rates to 6% in order to really get inflation back to 2%.
I think they have a ways to go. I think they're well positioned. If the inflation rate was 3.5% and the unemployment rate was 4.5%, but that's not where we are. The inflation rate's closer to 5%. It has shown no discernible or meaningful signs of easing over the last 6 months. The unemployment rate's going up for sure, but it's still well below 4%. I think they're going to have to go above 6% when all is said and done, unless they get lucky. And I think they should be signaling that to markets.
Does that fit with your line of thinking? Does that seem fair?
Listen, I'm going to leave the Fed to make its own decisions about what's necessary. Consumer spending has continued to grow in a pretty robust way, but we're also seeing areas of the economy that are slowing down. And this is a judgment that my former colleagues at the Fed are very capable of making. As I said, I think what's important is to try to bring inflation down. It's a top priority. We support the Fed's efforts to do that, and we're making the contributions we can, prescription drugs, healthcare costs, and other things, and a strong labor market.
Madam Secretary, I wanted to ask you about the banking business, but as it relates to commercial real estate, there's a lot of worry, as you know so very well, about the state of commercial real estate, especially around office and what that means to a lot of the regional banks, maybe not now, but come the end of this year, early next year, and the implications for that. Some people believe that there could be more bank failures. How concerned are you about that?
Well, I do think that there will be issues with respect to commercial real estate. Certainly the demand for office space, since we've seen such a big change in attitudes and behavior toward remote work, that has changed. And especially in an environment of higher interest rates, I think banks are broadly preparing for some restructuring and difficulties going ahead. But I think certainly stress tests of the largest banks show that they have adequate capital to deal with it. And I know the supervisors will be looking closely at a wide range of banks to make sure that they're adequately prepared to deal with it. But my overall read is that the level of capital and liquidity in the banking system is strong, and that while there will be some pain associated with this, that banks should be able to handle the strain.
Would you be supportive of more consolidation in the banking business? I ask in part because on the other side of the administration, I think the Department of Justice and the FTC in particular have been very aggressive about trying to prevent transactions, not necessarily in the banking space, but given how outspoken you have been and the issues that may be unique in particular to the banking business.
Well, I see strength in a banking system that has a diverse set of financial institutions capable of satisfying different needs across our economy. And we do have a diverse banking system with strong community banks, regional banks, larger banks that are involved in global business. And I wouldn't want to see that threatened. But certainly in this environment, some banks are experiencing pressure on earnings, and there is a motivation to see some consolidation. And it wouldn't surprise me to see some of that going forward.
Madam Secretary, virtually every interview that we've done over the many years with you, we've always mentioned crypto. I'm curious where you stand now on crypto, because I think there was an evolution in your thinking in certain ways. Maybe it's changed. I don't know. What's your sense for the American public who's thinking about whether to invest in the world of crypto today?
Well, you know, we recently wrote, Treasury contributed a set of reports in response to the president's executive order to examine the risks inherent in crypto. And we identified a number of risks, some of which risk to consumers, investors. Our laws are already strong. The SEC, the CFTC, and other regulators have the ability and tools to protect consumers and investors. And I'm supportive, very supportive of seeing those agencies use the tools they have. I can't comment on the individual matters the SEC is looking at, but I think it's certainly appropriate that they do that. And then I see some holes in the system where additional regulation, I think, would be appropriate, and we would like to work with Congress to see additional legislation passed.
Madam Secretary, very quickly, because I know we're going to run out of time, I have two very, very quick questions. One has to do with the global tax.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get your thoughts on the fact that the Republican Party is now really pushing back on that in a meaningful way, and where you think that really stands and whether that can even happen at this point.
Well, I think the pushback, frankly, is misguided. I think this is an extremely important agreement. Countries are beginning to adopt it. The EU is moving to put it in place, and other countries are as well. And I think this will stop the race to the bottom that's occurred over decades, in which countries have competed to make to try to get business to their shores.
But is that even possible to happen at this
American
point,
business.
Madam Secretary?
It's all 25 on the House Ways and Means. They all said there will be retaliatory action against any EU country that's they're saying no way, Madam Secretary. Well, is there a way around that?
I don't believe that legislation is going to become law. And I think that over time, as other countries adopt this minimum tax and put in place penalties designed to encourage countries that are not part of it to adopt it, that the United States and members of Congress will see that it is sensible and appropriate for us to put it in place as well. So I'm encouraged to think that over the next few years, we will adopt it, too.
And I know you got to go, but Live Golf PGA, you're the chair of CFIUS. Do you think there'll be a review? And I'm so curious what you thought of that transaction.
I really don't have anything for you on the golf situation. And I'm sorry to say I can't comment on cases that CFIUS is looking at. So
Will CFIUS look at this case? I know the Department of Justice is looking at the PGA, of course, in terms of an antitrust case.
CFIUS is very focused on national security. So
would this be a national security asset or maybe a strategic asset for the U.S.?
Well, it's not immediately obvious to me that this is an issue of national security, but I'm going to leave that to my colleagues who participate in CFIUS to decide.
What's your handicap, Madam Secretary? Do you go right or left on the?
I need a really big handicap and.
Need a lot to play. Yeah,
Madam Secretary.
I do indeed.
Do you pay your caddy in Bitcoin? Do you have any Bitcoin left?
Madam Secretary, yeah. Thank you so much.
U.S. dollars, the strongest currency in the world.
Exactly.
Excellent.
Secretary Janet Yellen, thank you so very, very much.
And she likes the dollar strong.
Yes. Thanks.
Next, the stunning marriage of rivals, the PGA Tour agreeing to a merger with Saudi-backed rival Live Golf. It's a game change.
Every incentive is totally wrong about what happened here, but keep going.
Keep going. Keep listening to Squawk Pod right after this.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod. A surprising merger in the game of golf making news. The PGA Tour agreed to merge with rival LIV Golf, backed by the Saudi Arabia Investment Fund. Now, these two competitors have had a rather ugly back and forth the last few years, antitrust lawsuits, and some pretty bitter rhetoric. Here's PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan, 1 year ago this month, addressing the large cash offers the upstart Saudi League was offering to pro golfers to lure them away from the PGA.
If this is an arms race, and if the only weapons here are dollar bills, the PGA Tour can't compete. The PGA Tour, an American institution, can't compete with a foreign monarchy that is spending billions of dollars in an attempt to buy the game of golf.
But yesterday, after the two sides agreed to combine their commercial business and rights into a new, yet-to-be-named, for-profit company, Jay Monahan said this on CNBC.
To have this capital at this point in time, with the strength of this game, there's so much opportunity. And it's opportunity we have not been able to activate, but we will now.
Stunning deal between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. I saw Phil Mickelson tweet. There he is, tweeted yesterday.
I mean, he's got to be.
It was a really good day, he said.
So happy for
him. They get the $200 million.
Every incentive is totally wrong about what happened here, but
you know,
keep going.
You know what else is weird is that before they did this, people were saying, you know what, none of the LIV golfers have even competed in any of the majors recently. Suddenly, Brooks Koepka almost won the Masters and shot three over in John Rahm. And then he won the PGA. It's suddenly, holy crap. And Cam Smith and...
And you're a week away from the U.S. Open.
Yeah,
what does this say to Rory McIlroy?
And all those guys.
What does this say to Tiger Woods, who turned down $800 million?
How about Rory McIlroy, who was the most outspoken of all of them, saying that this is wrong, we're not going to take the blood money.
Jack Nicklaus over the weekend said, I don't even consider the LIV players as part of the game. He said that 3 days ago, because it was his tournament at the Memorial. But months of... I understand 9/11. I understand everything about it, but the world is... so complex. You throw in China and people trying to navigate what you're going to do, and money does, makes people do strange things. It ends months of litigation and accusations and brings together the biggest names in the sport. It also brings controversy. Thank you. The PGA Tour has been criticizing the breakaway league over its Saudi backers ever since its inception, accusing the kingdom of trying to use the sport's popularity to whitewash its record on human rights. For its part, Saudi Arabia believes the PGA Tour was illegally using monopoly power to block it. And the new league, unnamed so far, will be chaired by the governor of Saudi's public investment fund, and PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan will serve as chief executive. The tour said that they will work in good faith to establish a process for any player or players who desire to reapply for membership with the PGA Tour after the completion of the 2023 season, and everybody's got an opinion on this, and we know what they're all worth, but I guess 5 years from now, golf could be maybe even a bigger deal than it is now, because now it's going to be run like a business instead of, but you know, what they were saying was it's all about the trophies and the history, and now we know it's really not all about just the trophies and the history.
What happens to the players who didn't sign with LIV? I mean, everybody else gets to come back to the PGA with all the money. They get nothing? Or are they going to make good
and try and
pay those people too? Because, look, this is about Brian trying to stop the animosity between the 400 top players, depending on where they were going. But it seems like that animosity is still going to be there if you don't make some of the other players.
You saw Twitter. Did you see Twitter yesterday? They had those things where they superimpose someone's head over a dancing figure. So I saw them where every LIV player was like coming out. This LIV players today dancing. And, you know, anybody who took the money in and it looked greedy, but they did it for their families. And what would you do if you were Phil Mickelson, you're 52 years old, you offer $200 million.
My question is the PGA some kind of national asset? Is the NBA some kind of national asset, well, by the way?
I don't know if you should bring the NBA.
No, no. Is the Major League Baseball some kind of national asset?
Money talks and BS walks at the NBA, too.
My question to you, though, is a different one.
Can it be foreign ownership? Is this going to be CFIUS?
Yeah. Are we going to get into a situation where all of these American leagues, we've had this great soft power in the world, actually, through sport in Hollywood. Are we happy? Would we be in a position to say, okay, come on in and do this again? Do it to the NBA. Do it to Major League. By the way, those are 501c3s. We've given them special antitrust protections.
As the PGA was a not-for-profit before.
Golf courses, interestingly, in the United States have some very remarkable tax breaks that are involved in how they're structured, if you know what's going on. We do a lot of things for sports in America, and I think we have to make some decisions. I'm not saying that sports are necessarily as important as microchips in terms of our national security, but I wonder.
This is not a new discussion either, though. I remember when the French didn't want Yoplait going into foreign hands, and I said, oh, these French, what's wrong? But then the Chinese bought our bacon. It's a, wait a second.
Right.
All right. Yogurt's one thing, but we don't want our bacon. We don't want our bacon.
What do you think about sport?
So we've been, why is sports different than bacon?
What about media?
Media, you worry, I mean, look at the whole TikTok thing. You worry about infecting our youth with Chinese, you know, with Maoism. I mean, I don't want that.
I think it's complicated. You're worried about them taking information on American citizens and storing it in China and what they then do.
And that, too.
By the way, if you are the DOJ, which is investigating for antitrust already, to me, this doesn't make the case go away. It actually makes it worse.
When you look at comparative advantage and globalism, and for years we said that you can't even question that we're going to do this. It's just obvious for the good of the world and growing the pie that we do this. Look how that's been reined in. Now we may need domestic companies
to
keep our supply.
You may need to call Lena Khan and be very happy if she tries
to block this deal. Nothing. You know what? We've learned that nuance might be the most important word in the dictionary. And they're gray because there's black and white. And none of these things are absolute. You know, that's the one word I never use because whenever anyone says absolutely, it's never absolute. Every time you ask a question to one of our guests, they say absolute. You say, is it really absolute? No, it's not.
You're
it's just your opinion.
Right.
I'm absolutely, in this case, I am absolutely right. But there are no absolute. I like to see you get so animated about golf. You know, for sports, it has to be business for you. That's what finally brings you
At CNBC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's an, we have to have that angle,
business
I guess.
Channel.
It was a shocker, I got to admit. It was a shocker.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. And here's what you can do for us. Tune in to our TV show weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. Get the best of our show in an audio format when you follow Squawk Pod. And hey, if you like what you hear, tell a friend to listen too. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.